they performed a movement of Robert Russell Bennett's symphonic songs for band, Celebration, the third movement. I fell in love with that piece. I fell in love with the way how Bennett reaches his audience. It's chaotic, but sophisticated. If I were to give it some type of an analogy, it's kind of like a middle school boys PowerPoint where they just add random everything that doesn't make any sense, but still combines everything together in a nonsensical way. And I'm just like, I need to know more about him and what he has done.
Hello, and welcome to episode 11 of the Bandwagon Podcast for the week of May 5th, 2024. On this edition of the program, news and notes from the band world, including tales of premieres and purloining, some thoughts about spring football, letters, we get more letters, and I have a conversation with an actual researcher who's made some actual band discoveries. I'm your host, Rob Hamerton. Hello, dear listener. I confess that in my little bullet point intro, I've misled you a bit. Chalk that up to wanting to keep it punchy and short. Punchy and short. I have all their albums. The second strain this week is not about football. A football event is just the context into which I get to throw a shout-out to some band friends of mine. A shout-out which doubles as a tale about being good hosts and about how once we're all in the middle of the band experience, or a band experience, age kind of goes out the window and we're all in it together. So, adjust your neck strap, and away we go. Let's play the first strain. In this episode's first strain, news and notes from the band world. Dateline, Irondequoit, New York. On April 21st, the Irondequoit Concert Band played a concert to celebrate its 50th anniversary. The band first met to rehearse on April 23rd, 1974. The anniversary concert, under the direction of David Chance, featured the world premiere of a selection entitled Where the Land and Waters Meet by Stephen Shewan, a retired Western New York music educator. The fanfare was commissioned in honor of the band's 50th anniversary. The program also highlighted the band's favorite items from the past half century, including one that was entitled A Piece for Didgeridoo and Band, composed by former conductor J. Russell Thomas. The Irondequoit Concert Band is a community band that performs a winter and spring concert and an outdoor summer concert series at locations throughout the Rochester, New York area. Where the Land and Waters Meet is a piece inspired by the Irondequoit landscape and the Seneca Nation. It incorporates the traditional Seneca canoe song, Kiawajina. By the way, and not unimportantly, if I've mispronounced that, in spite of any research I may have done, please by all means send me a correction. I'll talk about my willingness to stand corrected on stuff later in the program. Dateline San Diego, California. A hat tip to the reporting of Sean Stiles at KFMB TV CBS News 8 in San Diego. A Ventura, California high school band visiting San Diego to perform during the last week of April had an estimated $20,000 to $25,000 worth of their instruments stolen. The band, along with a choir from the Newbury Park Adventist Academy, had played a concert at a church in San Diego. They went to their nearby hotel to spend the night, and overnight, their van was broken into and more than 30 instruments taken. Many of those instruments were personally owned by students. At the time of the theft, the band and school administration were scrambling to find instruments so that the ensembles might complete their current school year performance schedule. They put out the call. Anyone who has heard about a whole lot of band equipment being sold via the internet or wherever has been encouraged to contact the Chula Vista, California Police Department. And now, a further hat tip to the reporting of NBC's affiliate station in Los Angeles as they followed up on this story a few days later. According to the Newbury Park School, community members have already offered to loan them replacement instruments. Joel Albritton, the school's principal, told NBC Los Angeles that, quote, "My email inbox has presented me with people we don't know. One woman offered a clarinet to donate. We received two flutes in a box just yesterday and cash donations, too, from people we've never met." In the spirit of being a proper band community, bands helping bands and all that, as has been spoken of in previous episodes of this podcast, if you think you may be in a position to help in this situation in some way, please do visit this episode's show notes. I've included a link to the school's contact page. If you scroll all the way down to the bottom of the page, you'll find an email submission form. And that's news and notes from the band world for this week. If you have a news item you think should be included in this segment, send me a link via email to heybandwagon@yahoo.com. Now we'll take a quick water break and meet you on the other side. Do keep listening, I implore you. Okay, let's pick it up at the second strain. In this week's second strain, this is your intrepid cub reporter with a news report live from... Well, I'd like to be able to say that this segment comes to you live and on location from McGurk Alumni Stadium in Amherst, Massachusetts. It doesn't, but at least I was able to record a little B-roll audio from there to make it seem like that. A couple of Saturdays ago, UMass Amherst held its annual spring football scrimmage, a curious tradition in which the football team splits into two squads, maroon and white, and plays a sort of pretend mock game in front of as many UMass football fans as want to come by the stadium and see them do their thing as they conclude spring semester workouts and run the schemes and packages and trick plays and whatever else a football team prepares as it looks ahead to the coming fall season. I have no idea what all those are, and I have no idea how they're dreamed up, prepared, or practiced, just as they have no idea how we band types dream up, prepare, or practice anything we end up putting out there on the halftime field. It's a football game with spectacularly low stakes. It's tackle, not touch football, but the tackles are designed not to kill anyone. There are referees, and at this spring scrimmage there were a lot of touchdowns called back for penalty flags, so the refs at least were taking their jobs quite seriously. But apart from that, it does look to me like a very structured practice. I think of it as whose football game is it anyway, where everything's made up and the points don't matter. Before the spring 2022 scrimmage, the athletic department apparently got in touch with the marching band office and said, "Hey, would you be interested in fielding a band for the game?" Doubtless the cheerleaders and dance team got similar phone calls. At the time, UMass band director Tim Anderson knew that the end of the semester was closing in and he wasn't going to be able to have the whole band there. So he put out a call on Facebook, basically, "Hey, any alumni who want to come to campus and kind of fill out the ranks a bit, you're more than welcome." I said, "What the heck?" packed my tenor sax into the car and drove cheerfully to campus, whereupon I discovered that the band was a decent size and that I was the one and only band alum crazy enough to accept Tim's offer. I tiptoed over to where the band was warming up outside the stadium, just in time for the warm-up to be over. I must have looked sufficiently, not sure where to stand, where to go, where to be, because a pair of tenor saxophonists and a flutist said, "Hello," and I said, "Hello," and they said, "I think we're just going right into the stadium now," and we all began the walk, and I asked them whether they were seniors or juniors or what, and they took a look at my gray beard and asked me what year I graduated, and I said, "1988, baby," and they said, "Oh, so was Mr. Parks your band director?" And I said, "Yep." And they asked what that was like, and I told a couple stories, and I asked them if they still played this or that tune in the stands, and by the time we made it up into Section 8, the band's traditional stadium perch, we were suddenly best buds, or at least friendly enough that I felt like I'd made friends. We were 3.5 decades apart in age. We were all playing in the same band, so what did it matter? In essence, those three undergraduates, Pat, Keanu, and Rebecca, tenor, tenor, flute, respectively, sophomore, sophomore, freshman, respectively, adopted me for the afternoon. Good hosts, they were. So, when homecoming of 2022 rolled around, I was one of those band alumni who got funny looks, maybe slightly envious looks, from other band alumni when I crossed paths with those three kids and we traded great big heys and hugs and handshakes. It was easy to find Pat. He was one of the drum majors. Also, he's about 9 feet tall. In April of 2023, I was all excited to hit the spring football scrimmage band gig again, and then of course it rained. Boo. But July of 2023 arrived, and with it my annual week spent teaching with the George Parks Drum Major Academy, and among the group of our collegiate helpers, which we call the Impact Team, were UMass Drum Major Pat and new UMass Drum Major Keanu, and UMass Flute Section Leader Rebecca. Of course, in the spirit of pictures or it didn't happen, at the end of the 4-day clinic, we made sure to get a photo taken of the four of us together, a group that Rebecca nicknamed the Alumni Adoption Agency. At Homecoming 2023, back in October, same story. Hellos and howdies exchanged, and most importantly, UMass Band Alumni Adoption Agency group photo taken. Which brings me back to two Saturdays ago. Together again, in the bright Amherst sunshine at the UMass football scrimmage. This spring, I was being taken care of by new tenor sax friends Hallie and Em, because Pat and Keanu were up on drum major ladders, and Rebecca was up in the percussion section with a pair of smashy plates. But as sure as the sun rises in the east, after the gig was over, the biannual group photo. This is not just a big deal to me because I enjoy making new friends, even though I do. This little tale, which has had numerous chapters added to it in the last couple years, is a bit of friendly pushback against the separation between current band members and most band alumni, other than maybe the most recently graduated ones that you can find at a homecoming. That sounds dire. It's not. But generally, unless an average college band alum is a parent or former teacher of a current band member, there is that invisible and understandable and totally benign barrier between the baby band, the undergraduates, and the alumni that visit campus once a year. We olds just don't know any of the youngs. The alumni stand on the sideline at the beginning of halftime and madly cheer on the kids who are killing it right now. And during the homecoming postgame performance, the current bandos feel the alumni energy cascading down at them from the cheap seats. But often, that can be as far as it goes, at least in that moment. But, among other things, this is what homecoming is for. Different generations of alumni connecting and reconnecting, trading hugs and handshakes and updates and old in-jokes. Thanks to happy circumstance and the willingness of the Drum Major Academy to keep me around, I'm just lucky to be able to connect and reconnect with the generation that hasn't been pestered by the Alumni Association's fundraising arm just yet. At any given homecoming day, I always want to say to the kids who currently wear the full uniform, these band alumni are the community that you will join a few weeks or a few years down the road. If we're doing it right, the band alumni community experience goes well beyond homecoming day, and that is a treasured thing as well. So, shout out to my band alumni adoption agency friends, Pat, Keanu, Rebecca, college graduate, rising fifth-year senior, and rising senior, respectively. A couple of years ago, they demonstrated that they knew how to play the band game very well, welcoming hosts and all that. And before very long, we're all of us going to be on the alumni side of the homecoming dividing line. And hopefully, that dividing line can be made to get fainter and fainter as time goes by. All right, let's do another grand pause, after which I've got a conversation for you that's about, among other things, research and a world premiere. More Bandwagon in a flash. Okay, let's modulate and get into the trio section. This week in the trio section, I'm pleased to be joined by a gentleman I was introduced to a couple of years ago, I think, on a typically warm August preseason marching band camp field. Since then, I've seen him on various podiums, and he's been part of a few groups you may recognize, but there's one project of his in particular that I found really intriguing, and I think you will as well. Welcome to the program, Richard Sargent. Hello, Richard.
Hello, Rob. Thank you for having me today.
A pleasure, and thank you for doing this. In the intro there and earlier in the podcast, I hyped that research project of yours pretty hard, and we will, of course, get to that promptly. But first, I'm going to offer you my now traditional opening set of quickfire band questions so people can get a sense of who they're listening to. So up first is, what's your primary instrument?
I play the tuba. That's it. Well, I play the tuba, and now I've evolved into conducting.
For the record, not only do I have no problem with tuba players, it's some of my best friends are tuba players.
The ongoing joke with tuba players is sometimes when something in real life goes wrong, all you say is, I play the tuba, and it kind of alleviates you from any responsibility. So that's kind of an inside joke for us.
In high school, our band program only had one tuba player, and he was a fairly quiet guy. And I went to college, and I discovered what collegiate marching tubas are like. And then it was after that that I discovered, that there's this stereotype about tubas being insane people. And I've known enough of them that it's the range.
So when I was in high school in Leesburg, Florida, my freshman year, we had 8 tuba players. And we were the insane section there. So it really, from what I've seen up north and down south, it's run for the course.
So with that, what bands have you been active with in your life, playing or otherwise?
In Florida, I started tuba in middle school at Oak Park Middle School, Leesburg High School. Did a couple of youth orchestras in the Central Florida area. When I was 16, I started drum corps at Magic of Orlando, drum and bugle corps. And that was their last their last season in 2006, went to Spirit from JSU at the time, Jacksonville, Alabama. And then I ended up aging out at the Cadets in 2011.
That was
a fun one. Since moving up north to Massachusetts in 2017, I've been pretty integrated in the Western Massachusetts community band circuit with Belchertown, Ludlow, Chicopee. And now this summer I'm going to be conducting for the 120th season, the Greenfield Military Band.
I sense a link for the show notes, but we'll move forward here.
Okay.
How did you get into playing the tuba?
I was reared by my grandparents, and money was a little tight. And because of that, we didn't have the money to rent instruments. So it was just like a $50 charge, and it took care of everything, provided a mouthpiece. It was just an opportunity.
When I ask that question, everybody's got a slightly different story.
Yep.
Everybody's approach to everything is ever so slightly different, which is
better. Everybody has a different thing to bring to it. And, you know, it gives you an insight of the person you're going to be listening to. Like, I come from a humble background, and I pride myself in that.
What's your current band-related role?
So right now, my current band-related role is I'm finishing up my master's degree in conducting at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, where I was the teaching assistant for the University of Massachusetts Minuteman Marching Band. And following this, like I said earlier, I'm going to be conducting the Greenfield Military Band this summer. And as for the future, that's still up in the air, but I'm open to whatever challenges and opportunities that the universe provides.
Future is TBD.
Yes.
So you are at UMass doing wind conducting studies, and along with that, or along near that, or nearby to that, has come along an opportunity for another project of yours, and it's the one that I will confess it's the project that made me think, I got to talk to this guy. The research project I've been hyping all along. Talk a little bit about this thing you've been doing.
In the fall of my first semester at UMass, we did this program called Bandtoberfest, which was pretty much an outdoor pops concert for the combined UMass Wind Ensemble and Symphony Band. And in it, they performed a movement of Robert Russell Bennett's Symphonic Songs for Band, Celebration, the third movement. And I fell in love with that piece. I fell in love with the way how Bennett reaches his audience. It's very chaotic, but sophisticated. If I were to give it some type of an analogy, it's kind of like a middle school boys PowerPoint where they just add random everything that doesn't make any sense, but still combines everything together in a nonsensical way. And I'm just like, I need to know more about him and what he has done. And then I'm just researching pieces, and I've just found this random website. It looks like it was probably made in the 90s. So one of those where I don't know if it's a really valid resource. And it had a piece called Six Tone Poems for Band. And I Googled it, and I can't find anything on this. And then I just found this one tiny little piece of information saying, oh, this was music that he wrote for the 1939 World's Fair. I'm like, okay, so 1939 World's Fair. Are we sure it was for band? That doesn't seem like it's a really, you know, big thing, because that was a really big event. So why wasn't it written for orchestra? And all these questions came up. And I went to my grandfather's brother's funeral service. And in this archive in the immediate area, I just decided to go check it out. And I search Robert Russell Bennett, George Washington, because one of the pieces is called The Spirit of George Washington. And lo and behold, manuscript, not checked out. So then I'm like, this one, this one, this one. And they had them all there in its entirety. So I scanned them. I spent about 4 hours just scanning and scanning and scanning. And I got 5 out of the 6 of them completed. So I started to engrave and engrave and engrave, putting it into Sibelius, which, by the way, if you've never done that, that is a very labor intensive mm-hmm. And nobody understand. Nobody who's never done this will understand. So I have a greater appreciation for the people that create my sheet music for me now.
Mm-hmm.
And just through this, I've just encountered a side of Robert Russell Bennett that has that chaotic energy with almost a romanticism. I don't want to say elite, but this is certainly not your grandmother's Robert Russell Bennett of The Sound of Music or Oklahoma.
And as it happens, when I was in high school, my first year as a little high school saxophone player, our band director put out for us to play an arrangement of Highlights from Camelot, and I am quite certain that that was Robert Russell Bennett's arrangement. I don't even know whether I thought consciously, but there was some sense of, oh, these transitions aren't just chord to chord go. In looking back on it, I feel like I sensed that there was more of a creativity to it than, you know, generically published Etude for Band by John Smith. Mm.
Yeah, and music from that time period just had, I'm going to get on a soapbox for a second, it just has a greater sense of craft and in those transitions and the melody and how it relates to people and how people are able to soak it in and enjoy it. Off soapbox.
Where else but something like this can one jump on a soapbox and go? I mean, this is kind of what it's for. So exactly a month ago, as this podcast episode drops, there was a little concert held at a little college put on by a sort of little band playing some big music in just about every sense of the word. And one of those items on the concert was your brainchild.
Yes, it was. On December 21st of last year, I was in Chicago for the Midwest Clinic, and it was my first time going. And in my research of Bennett, I found that he was given or bestowed an honorary doctorate degree from Franklin and Marshall College. And that was the only honorary degree and the only degree that he has. He didn't go to college.
Huh.
He studied with Mademoiselle Boulanger in Paris on a Guggenheim Fellowship. And that's the only degree that he has, is that honorary doctorate from Franklin and Marshall. So I reached out to Dr. Brian Norcross of Franklin and Marshall over email. I'm like, hey, if you're in Chicago, I have this really cool thought if you'd like to talk about it. And unfortunately, he wasn't there, but I reached out. He responded. And then we had a Zoom conversation where I showed him the beginning stages of what I've had done, gave him his choice of which piece to choose, and he chose one of the fireworks shows called The Garden of Eden.
So by fireworks show, we are meaning what?
At the 1939 World's Fair, we had fireworks shows. There were six different fireworks shows that combined fireworks, fountains, gas, and it was a really big to-do. And it was the most attended event at the fair at the time. And Robert Russell Bennett was commissioned to write all the music for it. So there's about 90 some odd minutes of music for band that we have still waiting to be fully discovered. Hmm. He takes the biblical story of creation and just goes wild with it. He starts with God, starts to cultivate the earth, let there be light. The animals are frolicking around. Eden comes. And then at the end, there's the serpent, and everybody's rebuked at the end. And God just says, you're out. And that's it. And it's just this 15-minute ride of just nothing that you would ever expect from Russell.
So it seems to me that this is the story of several things. The first of them is the creation, the loss, and the rediscovery of a piece of music. And the second is the background of its composer that linked it to Franklin and Marshall. And third, the re-premiering, is that a word? I suppose it is now, of the piece of music by the correct ensemble from a historical standpoint, and by an ensemble that if you're going into a project like this, and you may have an image of what the band is going to be like based on other projects that may have happened in a similar way, commissioned works for bands.
Correct. And when I got there, they gave me a private premiere of my own piece before the show, which was amazing. And I got to work with them for a few minutes. And the first thing that Dr. Norcross said was, raise your hand if you're a music major. And nobody's hand went up. And I thought, wow, for them to be able to take a piece of this caliber and do it as well as they did, it was a great time, especially considering all the other music that they had on the program as well, like The Lord of the Rings in its entirety.
I was about to say they had put The Lord of the Rings first on the program. And so therefore, as I was watching the concert on the live stream, I was looking at the program that they had posted with it. And I thought, that is, and before I even thought about whether there were music majors or not, I assumed that there were. And even so, I looked at that and thought, that might be optimistic.
Yeah, that was a very heavy and long program that they had, and probably a long day of playing, especially considering that they did two full runs of the Garden of Eden.
So Franklin and Marshall College, according to my online digging around, is not that large of a school. So you're dealing with the people that you're dealing with. And as we say, no music majors. And all of these factors that for people who have been involved with bands, you're stacking these factors on top of each other and thinking, what could this be like? Before I saw the live stream, I just knew it was the Franklin and Marshall wind ensemble. I hadn't done any of the digging ahead of time, so I listened to it and I was thinking, I've been around bands enough to think in terms of, okay, there's a little bit of an intonation thing there, there's a little bit of a balance thing there, blah 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 blah. And then we talk afterwards and you tell me that there aren't any music majors in this at all. Now, I was not a music major in undergraduate college life, and I know plenty of non-music majors who are good and decent players. But when you've got a band full of music majors, they all have private teachers as part of their course of study.
Yep.
So they all have people looking over their shoulders and pointing them in directions and crafting the sound and whatnot. So what they bring to it is going to be the difference between a public school kid who's having private lessons after school and one who's not. So it's not dumping on an ensemble to listen to it and think, okay, did you just hear that? Did you just hear that? Did you just hear that? But in the larger context, that was a whale of a performance.
Yes. And I would say that it is because of who Dr. Norcross is. He was able to bring this vision of music that hasn't been performed since 1940 and bring it to these young adults that just, they're happy to be there and they love what they do. And that's exactly what I heard in that auditorium. When that second wind hits in the middle, it was a magical moment.
And it happened to be the last concert of the semester for them, so there was recognition of seniors, and there were a couple of moments where they were giving seniors a couple of awards and introducing them person by person. And the response of the audience was, it was clearly not people who were thus who were only there because they had to write a concert review for a class. There were friends and family, and the reaction to the seniors from the rest of the people on stage, as I watched it on the live stream, it was different than a semi-professional band that's in for the night and whatever. This was a group of people that was doing it for the love of it.
Exactly. Yeah. And I just remember sitting there and saying to myself, for as small of an auditorium as this is compared to the Tillis Hall, that's a really big hall. They filled it up pretty well. That audience really wanted to be there and support their band.
And I wonder if you had known ahead of time that that ensemble was comprised of the people that it was and in the place that it was, would you have done anything different in, I mean, you're really taking the piece from what it originally was and just putting it into, as verbatim as possible, I suppose, putting it into modern computer music notation software and getting it there. But I wonder if there would have been something in the back of your mind, had you known, that maybe might have caused you to choose a different piece or approach the project differently, I wonder.
No, because I truly believe that the starting point needed to have some historical connection to Russell himself. And the more that I learn and the more that I research and the more that I find, it shows to me that there's this weird connection that I can't quite pinpoint with Russell and Pennsylvania. He wrote a commemorative symphony to Stephen Foster for the Pittsburgh Symphony, and I'd like to understand how that came about. Yeah. And then how the Franklin and Marshall connection truly came to be. Yeah. There's something there that at a personal level I'd like to kind of deep dive into.
Now, at this point in a composition's life, its composer often turns an eye toward the possibility of publishing it. Is there some potential for that, do you think?
I believe that there is potential for publishing, although there may need to be some type of prefaced edit saying, hey, you may want to consider taking this part out, mainly because it was written for a fireworks show. There's some developments that I don't want to say are stagnant, but it really required a visual element to fully understand. But there's this part that's the musical purist versus publishing. What do you do? And I think that I would personally like to see it published in full with the amendments marked in the score or in the program notes.
As distinct from making an arranger's decision for somebody and leaving something out that then will end up being lost anyway.
Correct. And that's not my intention.
And you want to leave it as whole as you can, obviously to honor the composer who made it and the composer's estate, I suppose. I'm thinking of questions I've heard raised about the Gershwin estate and the Bernstein estate being very careful with the music of its namesake composer to make sure that it's not misused in some way.
Yeah. And that's always a bit of a difficult situation to navigate, because for me personally, if I were to make money off of this, I'd feel really because there's a little bit of a gray area with the rights as it is. But in conversations with Russell's grandson Keen, we both want the music to be performed, and we want to continue Russell's legacy, because anybody who creates music wants it to be heard and it wants to be enjoyed. And this music for the 1939 World's Fair, millions of people enjoyed it. And I think there's a few million people that could still continue to enjoy this music to this day.
Before we finish up here, I do want to take an opportunity to ask you some slightly less resume bullet point sort of band questions. And my usual first one actually kind of lines up with this topic, because what's one of your favorite band pieces of music that you've played outdoors or indoors?
That's always such a hard question, because you think you have an answer and then You get this buyer's or player's remorse.
Huh.
This was a very recent piece that I did, but I absolutely loved conducting with the concert band this semester close to you. It was an arrangement of Burt Bacharach's Carpenter's song Close to You.
Okay, I was gonna ask, is that what I'm thinking of, or can that
yeah
be...
Yeah, and it was arranged by Takashi Yoshide over in Japan for the Tokyo Kasai's New Sound and Brass series. Japan just does band so differently, and their craft towards the pops music is unmatched. Every time I got to conduct that piece, it was just a fun time. That tune goes in such a different direction than you would expect it to.
So on the flip side, what's a piece of band music that you've never played but you would like to?
I've never had the opportunity to conduct October by Eric Whitaker. And that's such a lush, wonderful piece. I tend to gravitate towards luscious, lyrical ballads.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm a musical sap like that. I've played it on tuba, but there's something about being able to conduct that I think would be a highlight of my career when the time comes. The last time I played it, I was a junior or senior in high school. But that piece is always just kind of like circled back in different ways, and it's just lovely.
Another question, is there a band that you'd love to perform with that you haven't because you aren't the right age, or you're not in the right place, or don't live in the right century?
I don't want to be cliche, but I would love to have played in this World's Fair music.
Hey.
Because one, this music was written for the best of the best. You had Herbert L. Clark as one of the trumpet or cornetists of the band. And when you listen to the music, you just hear, oh my gosh, he's asking them to do what? So that would be really cool. And two, that was about the time when like unions were really beginning to flourish for musicians. But they were getting paid. And based on the contracts, the musicians were getting paid about $270 a week in 1939.
The problem with an audio-only podcast is you cannot see speechlessness, but that was just me.
So $270 a week in 1939, that is about $5,000 a week in today's time.
Tell me one of your favorite band stories, if you haven't already.
So my senior year of high school, we had the FCAT, which was the Florida Comprehensive Assessment Test. And juniors and seniors who had passed, we would get to job shadow. So my best friend, Chris, and I, tuba player, we decided to job shadow the principal tuba of the Sarasota Symphony, Jay Hunsberger, who was the man. So we got to like watch rehearsals and hang out with him for a little bit. But we lived about 2 hours away from Sarasota. His mother...
This was your friend's mom?
Yeah.
Okay.
Dropped us off at a hotel in Sarasota, gave us all a lot of money to pay for the hotel and eat and everything and get taxis for everything. We were roaming the streets at night. And I just remember getting a taxi because we had no idea where we were at the time. Mm-hmm. And the taxi's just like, what the heck are you two doing in the middle of Sarasota at this time of night? And he's just like yelling at us. I'm not even going to charge you guys. You guys need to get to your hotel and stay in. And that was just the time that I will just never forget. In addition to just getting to spend time listening to good music and having a lesson with Jay Hunsberger.
And finally, have you got a favorite band life lesson or a bit of wisdom that you've found useful outside of band?
So part of this may be in light of, you know, some of the current events that are happening in music across the globe. Just treat people with respect. It's not sage advice, but people will respond better when they're in a respectful environment, where they don't feel as if fears or humiliation is a factor of becoming better. And plus, people learn better when they aren't under those certain conditions. And if you're laughing, you're learning. I've had the run of the gamut of different conductors, leaders, teachers, educators, whatever. And the best ones that I resonate with most are the ones that I was able to laugh with in and out of rehearsal.
Well, sir, I so appreciate you agreeing to come on and talk about this project and some other stuff. There have been a number of conversations on this podcast so far on a number of band or band adjacent topics, but safe to say not any conversations on topics quite like this one. I just find this stuff fascinating, and I hope our listenership has as well. Are there places online where people can find out more about you or your work?
I'm just on Facebook. I live on Facebook, Richard Sargent. I believe my profile pictures me playing the sousaphone, so I'm pretty easy to find.
That, friends, is how you know.
And I just want to thank you for allowing me to share my experience, my research, and giving me the platform to share with everybody else who might find this interesting.
Conductor, researcher, tubist, Richard Sargent, thanks so much for your time and your expertise, and may success follow you all around the place.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hamerton.
Okay, we'll pause briefly, and then on the other side of that, a bit more bandwagon. Thanks so much for listening. Here comes the dogfight. This week's dogfight is another visit to the bandwagon mailbag. Virtual mailbag. Use your imagination, I guess. Via heybandwagon@yahoo.com comes this email from Sharon. Full disclosure, this is a person whom I've gotten to know by way of my work with a local community band, an ensemble I shall speak of in more detail some other time. But for now, this note with a bit of context. In the very first episode of Bandwagon, the dogfight contained an internet rabbit hole of the week, and it was His Majesty's Royal Marine Bands. And I made note of the differences that I thought I perceived between the Royal Marine Bands and the President's Own, of our own United States Marine Corps. And one of the things I noted was the Royal Marines' willingness to play medleys of hits by pop singers. My example was a medley of some of Elton John's works. Holding on to that reminder, here's what Sharon wrote. Hi, Rob. Finally got a chance to listen to your podcast. Just heard episode 1. It was very interesting and good. I don't listen to podcasts much, but we'll slowly go through these. I had one comment, though, about the President's Own. They do play Elton John. Elton did a concert on the White House lawn, and the President's Own was there. They play their traditional stuff before the concert, and at the very end of the night, they played an Elton medley. And at this point in her email, Sharon included a link to a YouTube video of that concert, which I shall include in the show notes for you. And Sharon notes that the U.S. Marine Band's Elton John medley is at the very end of that video. Friends, I am all too happy to be corrected on stuff. If I misspeak, feel entirely free to politely call me on it. Nobody likes a tyrannical podcaster or one who thinks he's got all the answers. And in this case, well, Sharon is someone who knows what she's talking about, for many reasons, but I think this is a particularly interesting one. Her son is currently one of the percussionists with the President's Own. I stand corrected, cheerfully. Okay, let's take a brief break and reconvene in a few seconds to put the finishing touches on this one. Thanks for staying with me. To wrap up this week, let's take the coda. For the coda this week, I cannot help but notice that this podcast has achieved 10 episodes. A milestone. Modest, but a milestone. Enough of an achievement that the good folks at Podbean, who host this podcast, sent me an opportunity to download a commemorative badge celebrating 10 episodes. I suppose I could print it out and wear it. Anyway, it's an opportunity to turn around, look back, see that there actually has been a path that's been laid down, and assess. What have we learned? What works? What doesn't? What should we talk about next? What should we never speak of again? I have some thoughts, of course, and you'll be unsurprised to know that I'd like to know what you think. How are we doing so far? And by now, if you're a regular listener, you know how to tell me that. But in a moment, I will cheerfully recite the email and voicemail contact links. And, well, I was going to say, I thank the literally hundreds of people who have downloaded and listened so far. Then I considered that could just be a handful of people downloading a lot of episodes each. You never know. But since Bandwagon has been downloaded more than 900 times since it launched, well, that's a lot of downloading per person for just a few people. I've done my part to keep the statistics pure by not actually downloading any episodes myself. That's how committed to accurate number reporting I am. Also, I'm a rule follower. Also, I'm a big nerd. But isn't that why we're all here anyway? The nerd part. A resource and a refuge, y'all. That's Bandwagon for this week. Thanks as always for downloading and listening. Bandwagon was written, researched, and produced by your humble host. Musical interludes were produced by Hammerton Media from source material largely by John Philip Sousa. You can listen to more episodes at our website, heyband.podbean.com. Please give me feedback. Be polite, but let me know what you like, what you think might change. Tell me your best band story, or suggest a topic for a future episode, whatever you like. You can do that using our email address, heybandwagon@yahoo.com, or leave us a 90-second voice message by going to speakpipe.com/heybandwagon. Be aware that we do reserve the right to include your message on the podcast unless you say otherwise. All those contact links and links to our news items, conversation topics, and this week's interview guest, Richard Sargent, can be found in our show notes. Please share the show on social media, and thank you for that. If you enjoy this podcast, get someone else to listen as well. Word of mouth is the best recruiting tool. And to keep up with us every week, subscribe to Bandwagon on the Podbean app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please give us a 5-star review. It really helps other people to find the show. For now, take care, stay in touch, stay in tune, and we'll do this all again next week. I'm Rob Hammerton. Detail, go home.